This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a really interesting book, a really important book that is maybe unfortunately, but certainly interestingly, quite close to a lot of political debates today. And as we're going to hear, kind of has been for much longer than we might think. The book is titled The Fasces, A History of Ancient Rome's Most Dangerous Political Symbol, published by Oxford University Press. And I have with us the author, Dr. Corey Brennan, who really in this book gives us a global, gives us an incredibly long and important history. By long, I mean the time period he covers. This is actually quite a readable book about what are the fasces, and why is this still so relevant to our politics today? So Corey, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's a great honor. And it's the first interview I've done about the book. So this is all new.
Well, then I think we even more than we usually do need to start off with you introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this.
Oh, certainly. My name's, well, as you heard, Corey Brennan, and for the last 24 years, I've been teaching Roman history at the State University of New Jersey, Rutgers. And I was not intending to write this book. Most of my work has been on sort of political institutions, and my most recent book before this one was the biography, as it were, of Hadrian's wife, the Empress Sabina, and that came out in 2018. And however, though, I was watching television in August of 2017, and I was shocked to see in Charlottesville, Virginia, this rally called Unite the Right, it was an assembly. It was like a Woodstock of hate groups that had come from all over the United States. And I couldn't believe I was seeing with my own eyes. And I was also taking a look at their flags and their emblems. And I noticed at least one group that had the fasces, and not just the fasces that, you know, one sees, for example, on the back of the old U.S. dime, et cetera. This was specifically the fasces as was used by Mussolini when he was running a Nazi puppet state from 1943 to 1945, the Republic of Salo. Because I'm very interested in the World War II era as well, and sort of the fascist period. And so I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was not just the fasces, which is you know, provocative enough, but specifically taking the darkest possible use of the fascies and putting it on a sort of banner and t-shirt. And that prompted me to write the book. It was indignation and the feeling that I could actually do something useful. I could actually contribute something to this discourse.
Thank you for giving us that backstory. And I think that answer kind of sets up very nicely the idea of the contribution, because of course you, I think many people were watching this on TV, but I don't think necessarily everyone watching had that same identification that you did of, oh, I know what that symbol is and where it came from. Obviously being a professor in Roman history very much helped you with that. But for those of us who are not experts in Roman history, can you please briefly introduce us to the fasci so that we can join you in that recognition and like, whoa, what's happening here? What are the fascis? What did they look like? Who used them and for what purposes?
Well, it's an unfamiliar symbol. And this is something that today, and this is what, you know, some of these folks have used what you can call plausible deniability. It's both not very well known. And also there's been lots of legitimate uses of the symbol over the years, as we'll see. But it, in essence, it's a bundle of wooden rods with leather straps with a single-bladed axe sticking out. And they're called the fasces because it's related to the Latin word for bundle. And in essence, it's a mobile kit for punishment. It was meant to show that authority, who would not carry them, attendants called lictors, would carry these fasces, these bundles. And it was a way to indicate authority, but also the readiness to, I mean, each element, the sticks, the leather strap, and the axe could be used to inflict corporal punishment, beating with the sticks, and tying someone up and then beheading them, capital punishment. So as you might imagine, and they were used in this way. It was not merely theoretical. There's instances, many instances attested from ancient Rome in which they were used, especially outside of Rome. And so as a result, they induced not just respect, but positive fear.
I mean, that description, even that brief description, sounds pretty terrifying. So now that we have kind of a sense of what they are and why they made such an impact then, I think that really helps us kind of get into understanding what was happening in ancient Rome. And then hopefully you can help us understand kind of how we ended up with them on TV the way that we saw it. So staying with ancient Rome, given that use case and obviously the fear that it comes with, when did people see the fasces? What was the sort of system for display? And to what extent was this kind of a super fixed thing that anyone in the world of ancient Rome at any point would have recognized? Or was this kind of very specific to a particular period or a particular place, and it would have looked very different, you know, even 50 or 100 years somewhere else?
No, they were ubiquitous. They were, in fact, that any subject of ancient Rome, whether in the Republican period or the Imperial period, would recognize this. They were hated. And to move toward the end of the story, in the first century CE, late first century CE, we actually have the number of people who were in the sort of union, the professional association that carried these fasces, the lictors, and they numbered 370. And so if you have 370 folks spread out both in Rome itself, but also across the empire, carrying these in front of Rome's magistrates. And so everyone had an idea what they were. They weren't depicted that often on coins. In fact, actually, it seems to have been such an unpopular symbol that the Romans of almost every age avoided using the fasces on their coins, but in their art, they can be seen. Everyone in the ancient world knew the symbol, and not just for 100 years or 200 years. They had a history of, you can argue, 2100 years. How do I get to 2100 years? They started with the Etruscans, Rome's not so friendly neighbors to the north, and it was a symbol of Etruscan kingship. And the Romans then adapted that because there was at least two Etruscan kings of Rome, but the Romans, when they chucked the kings out of Rome, and the traditional date's 509 BCE, they took the fasces. But the Etruscans had a double-headed axe to symbolize their king's power. And the Romans, who got away from a unitary king and divided the power of the king into two, gave a single-headed axe to two individuals, each of whom had the power of the king. And that, starting in 509, lasts in one form or another, believe it or not, down to the year 1453 CE with the fall of Byzantium. Because even if we go to the 14th and early 15th century, we see Byzantine kings parading with 12 attendants, Vikings in this case, with axes. So the symbol, and it's always a factor of six, has really sort of persisted. It's had an incredible, incredible run. I mean, literally, over two millennia.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm struggling to think of anything that has that sort of lasting power that we might recognize today. And it really is quite kind of hard to wrap our heads around. So in fact, to make sure that we can wrap our heads around it, because I don't think we could just kind of assume that we know what that feels like, can you tell us a bit more about how audiences, how people watching these parades received the fasces, given the time period, but also maybe you could speak to the geographic range of the symbol?
Certainly. Well, it starts in Rome. And there were protocols about how the fasces were used in Rome and outside of Rome. We're told at the very beginning of the Republic, in the year 509, the very first year, legislation was passed that the two heads of state, known as consuls, had to remove the axes from the fasces when in the city of Rome, because Roman citizens had the right of appeal against capital punishment. However, outside the city, and this, when I'm saying outside the city, not very far outside the city, I mean, where the Pantheon is today, you could put the axes back in. And so it's only in the sacred core of the city that the axes had to be removed. And they spread out. Anyone who saw a Roman governor, once they started the territorial provinces in Sicily or Sardinia, and then the Spains, North Africa, later Macedonia, and the list goes on, would have been acquainted with the fasces. And it was not just regular magistrates of the Roman state, but special magistrates. People were given extraordinary powers. Even eventually, by the end of the Republic, the priestesses known as the Vestal Virgins had a lictor with an axe and fasces, well, with the fasces precede them. And the list goes on. And then obviously, once Rome's emperors came in with Augustus and later emperors, they had to be fitted into the scheme. They got the full complement of fasces. We're told that some of Rome's empresses I think they all had a attendant at least with one fasces, but we're told that in time, already in the first century CE, empresses got them. So they were ubiquitous. So anyone who saw a Roman official of a certain level knew all about the fasces. And they were hated. I mean, we're told this specifically by, you know, it was not a popular symbol. People did not cheer when they saw the fasces. It was meant to terrify people. And we have lots and lots of evidence on the psychic effect of the fasces. So it was, it worked as a symbol for Rome, and it set a tone for Rome's political culture. And because the possibility of punishment, horrible punishment, was never too far around the corner.
So reading up to this point in the book, I was surprised we had kind of mostly forgotten about this, given the amount of time that the symbol is around, the spread of it, how frequently it would have been visible, and also, as you just said, the psychic impact of it. It's like, wow, goodness, how could we have forgotten such a thing? But I was even more surprised to then read that as we move further away from the ancient Roman period, we forget about it, but also we add new meanings, we add new symbolic aspects to the fasces that don't seem to have a lot of connection to ancient Rome, which again, given how kind of prevalent and embedded these ideas were, seems sort of odd to me. So I'm wondering if you can explain for us how, when, and why the fasces came to have additional meanings that aren't related to the story you've told us so far.
Yeah, this was something that I wasn't really aware of. How you got from point A to point B, and which is the fascists as a symbol of unity, because it's a very non-Roman concept. You see this, it's ubiquitous now, that the fascists connote unity and authority. And however, the way this came out was really by chance, and it was in the Renaissance. And there's in Aesop, as in Aesop's fables, there's a tale of an aged father who had quarreling sons, and he picked up a bundle of sticks, and he showed that he could easily break each individual stick, but if you bound them together in a clump, they were impossible to break. And this was meant to be a parable to his quarrelsome sons, that if they stick together, they're invincible, but if they are factious and quarrel with each other, that they're easily broken. But that's Aesop. And it was really in the Renaissance, really around the year 1500, that folks started putting the two together, totally unrelated, the fable of a bundle of sticks and the Roman fasces. In the 15th century, with the Renaissance humanism, there was a general awareness of what the fasces were, and it starts creeping into art in the late 15th, early 16th century. Raphael has a famous depiction of lictors with the fasces. But the idea of unity really comes into play really starting in the mid-16th century, and then it explodes. If we can actually pinpoint precisely when this happens, and it has to do with a very, very influential book in 1593 by someone called Cesare Ripa, R-I-P-A. And it was a sort of dictionary or encyclopedia of iconology. And it's a compilation of emblems. And he says, here's how, and has enormous, enormous influence on 17th century art, but and especially allegorical representations. But in this book, he presents both justice and also concord with a bundle of sticks. And pretty soon there was an illustrated version, and this makes an enormous, enormous impact. And then it becomes, to cut to the chase, really sort of generalized. It's used, the fascism as a symbol of love because it's, unity, or of equality because all the sticks are a equal size. And then it eventually just becomes a very generalized emblem for authority in general, especially, magistrates. And then under the neoclassical period, it really even loses that sort of, in the 18th century, loses even that meaning, where it's just used as a decorative element in wallpaper and the like, just to, connote the past or the Roman past. So it becomes really watered down.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Which is really, really interesting given what you told us about in the ancient Roman world. But given that kind of progression that you've just described, the watered down, the neoclassical, the idea of authority, but also unity, it's not hugely surprising then, if we're already talking about sort of the 1700s, that this does end up in the political life of what becomes the United States. Can you tell us about what that looks like specifically? How was the symbol used?
Yeah, the turning point, this is a really good question. The turning point is the year, specifically the year 1789. And it is both in France and also the United States Constitution's 1789. And that where the fascists takes on a new life. And as sort of, first of all, the French, they chose the fascists as a symbol of their movement's strength and power, commitment to justice, unity, and also this is a sort of a nod to the old Roman Republic, a dependence on the assent of the people, because we're told that the power of the fasces in ancient Rome really resided in that of the people. And there was a tradition that Roman officials would dip the fasces toward the people in an organized assembly. So the notion is that the power of the fasces really comes ultimately from the people. I mean, it's the symbol of magistrates, but the power of magistrates is because it's vested in the people. So these folks in revolutionary France really knew their classical sources really well, and they gave a new point to it. And then it eventually becomes, and this is a first, the semi-official seal or symbol of the French revolutionary state. Meanwhile, in the United States, folks were really taken with that old Aesop story about the unity. And there was how it sort of crept into American political discourse, but the Latin motto, a pluribus unum, one for many. The idea that the 13 original colonies of England and North America, if they grouped together, they would be invincible. The fasces became a symbol also of this. I mean, it's this sort of the idea of strength through unity. And I can instantly tell, you know, from a piece of furniture or the like, if it's an American fasces, because there'll be 13 rods. This is, you can always count the rods. And so the idea of fasces with 13 rods is the American fasces. So this, but it's completely independent, the French and the Americans. And both use them as symbols. Napoleon, not so much. I mean, Napoleon sort of turned his back on it, but in the 1790s, the fascists are everywhere. I mean, they're in every imaginable sort of possible context, including building enormous models of fascists and the like. In the United States, a little less so, but we're seeing it already as a sort of debated as a possible symbol for the 13 rebellious British colonies. Thomas Jefferson was very taken by the Aesop version of the story, but the official decision by the new U.S. Congress in August 1776 to adopt a pluribus unum, you know, out of many, one, as a national motto, that sealed the deal for the fascists, so to speak. After 1776, it was practically inevitable that the fascists was going to become part of the American sort of repertoire of symbols.
Really interesting to hear about that in the US and, of course, in France as well. It stays then, given that kind of embeddedness in the US, it stays there. But you do talk about in the book a, quote, dramatic escalation of fascist imagery when we get to the 1860s. Mm. Why and to what extent are these still the fascists we're seeing now?
Yeah, there was two different stages in this. First of all, after 1776, after 1789, the fascists really took off. And because a lot of America's early leaders and architects and artists, they knew a lot about classical antiquity, but they also had one eye about what was happening in France and what was happening in Britain. And there was a number of European artists that were doing very important work in the U.S. Capitol or as medalists or the like. So the fascists were pretty much hardwired into American political iconography already by the 1820s, 1830s. But then there's even more, because when the question of slavery in the United States comes to the forefront and extremely acrimonious in the 1840s and 1850s, the fascist becomes, on the one hand, a sort of a plea for unity, but also it was taken, at least by folks in the southern future secessionist states, as a symbol of abolitionism and pro-abolitionism. And as such, we see a fight in the 1850s about, you know, with the design of the U.S. Capitol building, there's a on the crown of the cupola of the Capitol, there's a really, really interesting use of the fascists, which was fought by no other. I mean, Jefferson Davis, for example, he was in charge of the architectural extensions of the Capitol building. And he bitterly opposed the use of the fascis. But on the cupola of the fascis, of the Capitol is a depiction of bent fascis. They're the sticks are sort of bent. And that is sort of combining the Roman emblem with the Aesopian idea that even under extreme stress, the fascis will not break the bound. And this is the sort of the symbol of unity. And then the climax of all this was in 1857, when the House of Representatives is sort of remodeled, and actual fascis framing the speaker's platform on both the left and right are introduced. And they're still there. They're, in fact, not the original ones from 1857, but a, in fact, even larger version and more prominent version, which was done in 1950. So it's a symbol of union, but it's also implicitly and was taken very much as such. And I detail this all in the book as a symbol of abolitionism. So I can't understand the folks that say, to cut to the chase, get rid of those fascis in the House of Representatives. Every day on what used to be known as Twitter, now known as X, every single day, there's someone who discovers that there's fascis in the House of Representatives. They said, take them down, and thinking that this was installed as a sort of a secret message about, the fascist leanings of the United States government, but it has nothing to do with it. It's a symbol of unity and, by extension, abolitionism.
Okay, but something happened between then and now such that people are making these calls. So can we talk about kind of where that aspect of it comes from, which I think pretty obviously is Mussolini? Why was he so obsessed with the fascis? I mean, you go in so far as to say that he tried to bring them into, quote, every crevice of Italian public and private life. I mean, what was the big deal with the fascis for Mussolini, and to what extent were his efforts to do this successful?
It's absolutely intriguing. I would say that when Mussolini came to power in a coup d'état of 1922, that the fascis was a much better symbol just in general worldwide than it is now. And not due to Mussolini, but for example, in the Lincoln Memorial, which was dedicated by coincidence in 1922, but the sculpture of the seated Lincoln with his hand on a chair in which the arms are made out of fascis, and then there's fascis all over the Lincoln Memorial. This was done before anyone knew there was going to be something called Italian fascism. But the story of Mussolini and the fascists is interesting, and I never really saw it laid out. But in outline, it goes something like this. This is the 32nd version. That in Italian political vocabulary, there, since the 1890s, there was something known as fasci. And fasci are a sort of a loosely, it's bundles. I mean, basically, they're people who may have different political ideologies, but are sort of bound together by a common goal. And there was a pejorative term for these people, which we see already in Italian newspapers in the 1890s. They're called fascists, fascisti. But it was always pejorative. I mean, and it means revolutionaries or people causing trouble or bucking against the status quo. Well, Mussolini, in starting around 1915, actually a little later, decided to use the tag fascisti for his own followers. I mean, he had something called the Italian fasci of combat, and he proudly appropriated the name fascisti. But as far as actually using the symbol, the fascis, that came surprisingly late. It was only in the run-up to a general election of 1919 that he used it for branding. And it was a way for people to identify that there was a fascis in profile that looked very much like a French revolutionary fascis with the X on the top. So people could identify his party members on the ballot. And then it really takes on a life of its own in the years 1920, 21. But in 1922, very early, right after the March on Rome, which was late October of 1922, that brought Mussolini to power as prime minister, one of the first things he does in November, weeks after coming into power, is to make sure that the fascists get on coins. Now, one thing I've done, there's a lot of footage, a lot of the March on Rome of the 28th through the 30th of October. And I went frame by frame. I don't know how long it took me, but just seeing how many people used the fasces as a symbol, you know, on their military cars or their, and it's extreme. There's some, but it's not ubiquitous. And however, as a branding technique, and to sort of give a sort of unitary sort of identity symbol to his movement, in November, things really step up and they start already saying, how can we get this onto the coins, but also onto cigarette packaging, which was then a state monopoly? How about postage stamps, all sorts of small media? And it was a way to just constantly, so any contemporary Italian could not reach in their pocket, whether for a cigarette or for spare change or stamps, without seeing the fasces. And there was a lot of, I spent a lot of time in the book on one fringe group of occultists who basically said, you know, we have a spiritually supercharged fasces with a real Etruscan axe head on it. And, you know, thinking that this was going to give some sort of charismatic power to Mussolini, there's a lot of jostling, but the ploy didn't work. And but by summer 1923, we see the fasces on coins, and then something bizarre happens. It's not just small media, but it is everywhere. In fact, entire buildings, the Florence train station, as seen from the air, resembles a fasces. And Mussolini, you know, explicitly complimented for doing so. Also, one thing that has not been noticed is Stazione Ostiense, which was built for Hitler's visit in 1938, is in the shape of a fasces. But there was a competition in 1932 to build a new fascist party headquarters where people were tripping over each other. Who could put the largest fasces? One model had a fasces towering over the Colosseum itself. It was meant to be next door to the Colosseum. And but then that was not enough for Mussolini. If I can go on, he took the word lictor. First of all, the way Mussolini interpreted the fasces was not in the standard way that people had done for the previous 2,800 years. What he did was to say that it's a symbol of unity by means of authority. I mean, everyone else had it the other way around. But unity by means, imposing unity by means of authority. And then he chose a very unlikely subject, the lictor. And the lictor is the humble attendant, usually freed slaves in ancient Rome that would carry the fasces. It was boring work. It was hard work. These things were heavy. It was just tedious. They had a certain amount of pride, but and I talk about the lictors in antiquity and how there was some social mobility, but it was not a glamorous job. And he glorified the lictor, saying that Italians should take the place of the lictor in carrying the fasces. And so, it's subservience, you know, to the state. Then he uses the word literali, which is an adjective he made up, which means lictor-like. And that becomes a, for competitions or based, everything. There's the Italian national airline becomes alla littoria. There's a town called Littoria, you know, so L-I-T-T-O-R-I-A. And so the not just the symbol of the fasces, but also the symbol of the lictor. And this is a first. This, like, no one ever had glorified the lictor before Mussolini.
This is so interesting to kind of see in such quick comparison. Obviously, we're not doing the detail in the book justice, but hopefully we're giving a highlight sense of it to see all these changes of meaning and adaptations kind of in close comparison. So thank you for taking us through Mussolini and kind of what he's doing within Italy. Can you now explain to us kind of what were people's reactions to this outside of it? Like, did it make people go to the Lincoln Memorial and go, hang on a second, this is now a very different symbol? Or what impact did it have?
It was slow in coming. It was very interesting to see in the 1930s in New Deal in the United States. And one of my regrets, I should say, about this book is that I had this idea that I was going to do a global history of the fasces and look. I mean, I collected evidence from Morocco, from Vietnam, from, I mean, I did the research for the entire world. But in writing it up, I really could only focus on Italy, France, and the United States. So I didn't get to Great Britain, except in a very tangential way, or the Commonwealth, et cetera. So I'm just speaking what happened in the United States. In the United States, there, people doubled down because it had been a legitimate American symbol, political symbol since, you know, the days of the Declaration of Independence. And so the idea, rather than saying, well, Mussolini has brought the fascists into play, so we're going to abandon it. No, rather, they doubled down because on every American dime at that point that had been minted after 1916, the fascists was depicted. And so everyone, you know, or many people had coins in their pocket with the fascists, and that continued to be minted. They didn't stop that. But also on New Deal architecture, the fascists proliferate in the United States. And there's very, very hard to find any federal building that was built in the 1930s. And there's plenty, or federal building outside, you know, federal courthouses outside of Washington, D.C. that do not have fascists on them. So it's playing spot the fascists in D.C., especially for the 1930s. It was only with Italy's declaration of war on the United States that things sort of changed. And in the 1940s, there's a debate about, you know, should we be getting rid of this dime, or, you know, how appropriate is this as a symbol? And at the first breathing space, which was in late 1945, it was decided to get rid of the fascists on the dime. And a new dime was introduced to honor the recently deceased President Roosevelt. And there's a fascist-like torch on it. They call it a Liberty torch, but it really has some of the attributes of a fascist. And then after 1945, 1946, you really don't see anyone putting up new fascists. It just doesn't happen anywhere. However, in Italy, they don't take them down either. Or if they do it, it is at a very haphazard and unevenly funded way. So today in Rome, it doesn't take very much effort to, or other Italian cities as well, but Rome is the city I could cite chapter and verse on, to see fascists everywhere. I mean, you're walking over them. In particular, the manhole covers, I would say a good percentage of them still have the fascists on them. They haven't been replaced since the fascist era. So there's no, unlike the swastika in Germany, there is no really concerted effort to get rid of the fascists. There's plenty of them to be found.
Why haven't they been taken away?
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, there's some monuments. I mean, for example, one thing that when I first really went to Rome for a year, I've lived in Rome for 4 years. And in 1987 is when I first arrived. One of the things that was the most surprising was to see a 770-ton obelisk at the Foro Italico in Rome, right near where AS Roma and Lazio play, right near the soccer stadium, the Stadio Olimpico, with Mussolini's name on it and fascists galore. And then to get to the soccer stadium, what I'm calling the soccer stadium, but Stadio Olimpico, you have to walk across a mosaics in which there are hundreds of fascists, and they've, you know, never been covered over or torn up or the like. And my Italian friends in the 80s, and I thought this was a very strong and compelling explanation, is that our democracy is so strong that we could keep these symbols up as a reminder of what we went through in the so-called Ventennio, the 1922 to 1945, and we don't have to eradicate this. And another way was, this is, we Italians, we forget, but we do not forgive. That was what one of my friends said. But so you don't have to go very far to see explicit symbols of fascism. And the most dense is right near the Stadio Olimpico. So it wasn't taken down. There was a debate for the 1960 Olympics. I discussed this in the book about what to do with these symbols. And there was a extremely half-hearted attempt, which only lasted a few days, to start chopping out some of the more objectionable stretches of this mosaic floor. But far right forces in Italy responded by spraying pro-Mussolini graffiti all over the center of the city. And so there was a standoff, and they decided to stop the eradication of the symbols. And the Olympics went on. And may I say what the world reaction was? Nothing. Zero. Mm. There was like no one picked up on it. I mean, there. I have a scholarly interest in the 1960 Rome Olympics. I think it's a real turning point for modernity. And the international reaction was muted. No one objected. And the official film basically for the Olympics, which is one of the most beautiful films ever made, The Great Olympiad, came in 1961, really tries very hard not to show any fascist era memorial, and not just fascists, but really a good part of the games was carried out in structures that Mussolini expressly built. It doesn't dwell on it.
Very interesting. Thank you for taking us through that and allowing sort of the follow-up of why not. I think there's a lot of things, obviously, that readers can take away from this book, perhaps at a most like literal level. If you're anywhere near Washington, D.C. or Rome playing spot the fascies, now you'll know what to look for and why it's there. But is there anything else you hope readers take away from the book?
Yes. I mean, one of it is that I have a routine. Every day I go on to what was formerly known as Twitter and just to see what people are saying about the fascists. I'm just very interested. Now, okay, full disclosure, I'm interested to see if anyone's talking about my book, either in a positive or negative way. But I'm just interested in seeing. And it is, I'd say the book so far has made zero impact, none, like none whatsoever on popular discourse, none. And I'm hoping that people read at least the reviews and sort of take away. I mean, for example, one very strong narrative that you see on the internet with folks promoting this with 75,000, 100,000, 200,000 followers is that the fascists, in fact, were supercharged electromagnetic devices. And one account, which has since blocked me instantly, said the fascists were made out of uranium and that they were used as some sort of proto-nuclear power by the Romans, and that's how they, you know, built their empire. And this gets thousands of likes. This is like, oh, thank you so much for telling us the history that historians are trying to keep from us. Now, I pointed out on this site, and this is something ChatGPT is very good for. I said, I'm trying to build fascists with the following dimensions. However, I want to make them out of uranium. And basically, it gave me the answer that a standard Roman fascist made out of uranium, leaving aside all the other dangers, would weigh 600 kilograms. Now, how anyone would carry a 600 kilogram fascist is beyond me, but that's how much it would weigh. But this is just, it makes me, well, at first it really bothered me, especially because of the platform these folks have. Just, I mean, this is fake news with a capital F and capital N. But also, you know, allowing hate groups to get away with using the fascists, I mean, in the same way as that was I talked about with Charlottesville, that's something that I think really has to be stomped on. And and this is what the book is about, is that you could get away in the year 2024 with using the fascists because it is such an unfamiliar symbol and people will see it. And then you have the so-called plausible deniability. Say, well, you know, basically this is just an old French revolutionary symbol, or it's an old Roman symbol, or it's an old American symbol. But I'd say that unfortunately Mussolini made it impossible for the symbol to be revived. I don't think it can be brought back in any way, shape or form. I'm not saying take down pre-existing fascists, but on the whole, people have not been putting up new fascists. I can just think of one example. Do you want to hear the example?
Please.
It's on the campus of Princeton University. And a sculpture was put there in 2001, which has a 5-foot fascist on it. And which is, it's a statue, it's a twin statue. There's one in Paisley in Scotland. It's a very gifted Scottish sculptor, neoclassical sculptor called Alexander Stoddart, really one of the greatest neoclassical sculptors of our age. But he made an attempt, and he explicitly said so, that these symbols should not be kept in the grubby hands of a Mussolini, and that Mussolini should not have the last word. So he tries to reintroduce it, but he's alone in this. And I think But the thing that's very interesting is that for other reasons, folks have raised a lot of controversy about this. Have seen a lot of how controversial the statue John Witherspoon is. It was found out he was a slaveholder. There's folks that want to see, at the very least, the statue contextualized, which I fully agree with, in some cases even taken down. But interestingly enough, no one has recognized the fascists. I write about this in the book, that I found one Instagram user who misspells the word fascists. But other than that, there had been no public discourse about the fact that in 2001, a monumental sculpture right across from Princeton's chapel and library, and classics department for that matter, was set up and can go unnoticed. So I just want to raise general awareness. Not in a sort of effort to have, pre-existing art taken down, but to be sort of understood, contextualized, and also for hate groups not to be able to use the symbol carte blanche.
Mm. Well, aside from monitoring kind of public discourse on this topic, and obviously more people hopefully being aware of all this context from listening to this interview and reading the book, is there anything you might be working on now that this book is out in the world, whether or not it's on the fascists, whether or not it's a book that you'd like to highlight to our listeners?
Oh, I'd love to plug it. For the last 14 years, I've been working on a book on a garden park in Rome called the Villa Ludovisi that was largely destroyed in 1885, but it was a 17th century park of incredible size, 61 acres, that there's only two elements that still survive. The U.S. Embassy in Rome is in a former palace that was in this garden, and also a home, which is still, as of today, a private residence called the Casino dell'Aurora, which has a unique Caravaggio ceiling painting, the only one he ever did, plus work by 12 other major artists, Domenichino and Guercino and many others. And also, I would argue, a unrecognized sculpture by Michelangelo. And there's a bit of urgency because the house has been up for judicial auction since January of 2022, and its fate, as I speak today, is completely uncertain. And so it's about this structure that was built on land that once belonged to Julius Caesar, then the Gardens of Sallust, and became an imperial retreat, and then played an outsized sort of role in starting really in the 17th century and then beyond as a must-see spot on the Grand Tour. And it's not well known because it's been a private residence. In fact, notoriously difficult to get into at every stage of its history. And I've been working with Princess Rita Boncompagni Ludovisi, a Texan who married the head of the family and is now widowed. And she and her husband gave me complete access to everything. I mean, the entire house, its archive, which was unrecognized. And if you can follow the whole story at villaludovisi.org. But I have a book coming out with Princess Rita Boncompagni Ludovisi on the structure. It's going to be published by Breppols. And the manuscript should have been submitted by now, but in a very short amount of time, it will be. And so it's a story that combines lots of different elements and that takes us really in a straight line from the days of Julius Caesar to the present second.
Hmm. All right. Well, good luck finishing up that project and getting it out into the world. And in the meantime, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled The Fascists, A History of Ancient Rome's Most Dangerous Political Symbol, published by Oxford University Press. Corey, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, Miranda, thank you so much. It's a great honor. And what can I say? This is a really, really exciting moment for me. And I'm so glad I was able to chat with you.